This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Why aren't more Americans going out to the movies? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, the daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Hollywood's dismal box office has been widely reported this summer, but there's a vast range of differing explanations. Whatever the reason, 73% of respondents in one poll said they'd rather watch movies at home. Is it DVDs, video games, and home entertainment centers? Economic uncertainty, post-9/11 malaise, teenagers with too much to do, or are this year's movies just lousy? On To the Point, we'll hear from critics, studio executives, and theater owners. Is Hollywood in for a shakeup? Will future premieres be at Walmart? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. This summer's movie box office revenues are in the tank, and Hollywood's looking for answers. On To the Point, we'll hear explanations ranging from DVDs to teenagers with too much else to do. Or is it that this year's movies are just really bad? First, this news update. A month after 56 Londoners died in bombings on buses and subways, and 2 weeks after a second attempt that failed, Prime Minister Tony Blair today announced a crackdown.
If someone is a foreign national coming to preach in this country, they are not going to be preaching this type of extremism. And if they do, they've just got to understand they're not going to come in. And what I'm trying to do here is, and this will be followed up with the action in the next few weeks, as I think you will see, is to send a clear signal out that the rules of the game have changed.
Tony Blair at a news conference today. George Jones is political editor of London's Daily Telegraph. George Jones, thanks very much for being with us. What does the Prime Minister mean when he says the rules of the game have changed?
Well, he basically says that up until now, Britain has been a very tolerant country. It's permitted people to come here, particularly from... Hello?
Yes, we're here. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I get an awful buzzing.
We have a buzzing too, but we can understand you. Go ahead.
Yeah. There's an... Sorry,
Okay, we seem to have lost George Jones for the moment.
Hello?
Oh, there you are. You're back again.
So the rules have changed. What he means is that Britain has been a country where people have been able to come. They may have been persecuted in their own country. They may have been accused of terrorist acts, but they've been allowed to come to Britain because we've always put human rights before as the most important thing. But he says these people have abused British hospitality. They have radicalized young Muslims in this country. They've preached hate. They've preached extremism. And he says that in future, if you do that, you will be deported. The only point is that the government itself cannot just deport people at will. The courts can step in and block him, block the government from doing it. So he's announced that's what he wants to do, but he still faces a battle to get it through the courts.
Haven't the courts recently voted down measures that would have allowed him to detain foreign terror suspects longer without charges?
Yes, they have. And at the time, the judges said the threat to the British way of life came more from the British government introducing tough new laws to curtail civil liberties than they did from the terrorists. But that, of course, was before we had our own much smaller version of your 9/11, which was our 7/7 bombings on the London Underground and buses. I think a lot of people now think that actually your human rights are to go about without being blown up by suicide bombers are rather more important than the suicide rights of radical extremists who might want to take advantage of Britain's more liberal laws.
In addition to cracking down on foreigners in the way you've described, he also wants, among other things, to close mosques that he thinks have been centers for fomenting extremism and says he'll consult with Muslim leaders on that. Do you think the Muslim community, the moderate Muslim community, is going to go along with that?
Well, the moderate Muslim community is worried. They feel they are being stigmatized. They feel that, they say that these bombers, although they acted in the name of Islam, are not true Muslims. I think some of them accept that, I think they accept the argument. It's an argument which has been made by the United States. It's an argument which has been made by countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, that Britain has been too lax. It has allowed radical extremists a voice and a base in London. So I think they support some of the measures to crack down on the extremists, but at the same time they are worried that they are being stigmatized, that they are being singled out, you could have racial attacks. There have been a number on mosques, on Muslims in the street who are wearing, particularly Muslim women, who are wearing a sort of full traditional veil. So I think they agree with some of the measures, but of course, I think they're worried that they are being singled out for criticism.
We're talking with George Jones, who's political editor of London's Daily Telegraph, on To the Point from PRI. What about human rights groups in general and people concerned about what you referred to earlier as a tolerant policy for immigration? Is the Prime Minister liable to get into political trouble with them, or do you think there will be overwhelming support for this amongst British voters?
Well, I think there will be a large amount of support among British voters. I think Tony Blair, if you go into the average bar in Britain and you talk about this, I think the average Briton would say, chuck these people out. Tony Blair's wife, Cherie Blair herself, is a well-known human rights lawyer, and she has said the courts have to stand up and prevent a government from taking away human rights. And we have a big human rights industry in this country. But I think, of course, Tony Blair himself, he's an elected politician. He feels he's reflecting the views of the British public, but he has a real battle ahead, first with the human rights industry and the lawyers, and with the courts, and it's by no means certain the courts will do what the government wants, and it's not just the British courts, it's the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg in France. It can intervene, and it can say the British government can't do these things. So there's a huge battle ahead, but what I think is significant is that Tony Blair now believes the balance has tilted too far in human rights, political correctness, and has got to shift back in favor of the ordinary rights of the ordinary British subject.
We'll be following up on this starting on Monday. George Jones, thanks a lot for being with us. Right back with To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Norman Olney back with To the Point. Nobody disagrees that Hollywood box office revenues have been dismal this summer, but explanations differ, and some veterans insist it's only a passing phenomenon. But Edward J. Epstein's new book, The Big Picture, contains some stunning statistics. In 1948, 90 million Americans went to the movies, 65% of the population. Last year, that number was down to 30 million, or 10% of the current population. Michael Wilmington is film critic for the Chicago Tribune. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Well, what do you think is going on, and has it gotten worse in the past few years, given those rather amazing statistics going all the way back to 1948?
Well, we're talking about really two different things here. We're talking about a whole long-range trend that's been going on since the high water mark of movie attendance, which was in the World War II years. I think the strongest year was probably 1946. And then we're also talking about a really record-setting stretch this year, when a record-setting number of weeks with lower attendance than they had last year. And I think they're really two different things. Remember, one of the big chunks that was taken out of movie attendance came with the TV years, and the movies have been fighting back ever since. But if we want to just kind of hone in on the original question a little, the reason for the falling box office this year has actually been a lot of lousy movies. The movies that have been released by the studios that were supposed to make a lot of money, the supposed tentpole movies, a lot of them have been really disappointing. They've gotten bad reviews from the critics, and they've gotten poor attendance from the audiences. And this trend, this malaise, if you want to call it that, has even affected some good movies. Cinderella Man, Ron Howard's movie with Russell Crowe, should really have done a lot better than it did. It was a nice little movie, and it kind of tanked, relatively speaking, maybe because of the time at which it was brought out. But I'm looking over the list of films that have been running during this period, and they're really bad. They're really disappointing. And also, there have been films that were in major landmark series like Star Wars, which was a pretty good movie and did well, but did not do as well as some previous Star Wars movies. Spielberg's War of the Worlds did not do as well as some previous Spielberg movies.
Well, what are some of the movies that have really been bad? What do you mean when you say they've really been terrible this year?
Well, let me look over this list. There's Monster in Law, House of Wax, Jiminy Glick, and La La Wood. I shouldn't pick on that. That's just a small movie. X-Triple, I'm just going down the list in front of me. Triple X, State of the Union, terrible. The Amityville Horror, Sahara, Beauty Shop. That wasn't such a bad movie, but these, Longest Yard, Miscongeniality 2, Armed and Fabulous. These are all movies, The Ring 2.
I don't want you to wear out your computer.
I don't want to wear out that list. But these are movies that are all tremendously disappointing, and they're all cliched, and they all fall into well-established formulas. And these formulas have probably run their course, a lot of them. At least they've run their course in these particular films. If I can look at the bigger picture on what these movies are like. In the 1980s, Hollywood largely stopped, with few exceptions, and those exceptions would usually come up every year around Oscar time, making movies for adult audiences. They basically started catering mostly to a juvenile audience, a teen audience. I think their ideal audience was about a 15-year-old in a shopping mall. And those are the kinds of movies that we tended to get throughout the 1980s. Now, the audience was then broadened by DVDs, by videos, by cable TV, and the older audience was brought back into the picture, and that audience fuels kind of the major success of DVDs and others. But that isn't reflected in the major movies, the major kind of studio movies that come out. I'm looking over this list, and I'm also actually seeing a lot of extremely good movies, but they tend to be independent American films, foreign language films, documentaries, and those aren't the films that, given the current strategies, are supposed to be fueling the box office. And that, I think, is the problem. I think that the studios have to start making different kinds of movies appealing to a broader audience, and not just depending on the audiences they have been depending on for a long time, which are basically the teen and 20 audience, and then the overseas audience, which they expect to come to the action movies.
Michael Wilmington, film critic for the Chicago Tribune. Bob Burney last year released the hugely successful Passion of the Christ. He's now president of Picture House Films, which recently released the new Gus Van Sant film, Last Days. Bob Burney, glad to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Warren.
Last year, certainly, The Passion of the Christ was not what you would call a formula movie, and it did so much business that it apparently really jacked up the total box office take. So could we set that aside and look at the broader picture? And on that basis, would you agree with what we're hearing from Michael Wilmington?
Well, I do agree that I think a lot of the problems are sort of film-based. In other words, they haven't, good or bad, critically or not, they haven't, as many films haven't connected with the broader audience. That said, I think that there are a couple other factors, perhaps the availability of DVDs sooner than later. People might say a marginal movie, they might just wait and see it on DVD. Also, the fact that more and more, for the trend, wider and wider releases where you have this huge kind of explosion in so many theaters the first weekend, it tends to be, you know, just next. That said, I think a couple good films turn that trend around. While there are some troubling notions about new technology and shortened windows, I really do agree that the basic problem is that the sort of some of the formulas are not working anymore. But then you look when he talked about the independent sector, I think there's ups and downs there too. But certainly if you look at this year, a film like Crash that, you know, really people responded to, urban audience and kind of critics, the current Penguin movie that's out, that, you know, people are finding it. Reminds me of when we did at Newmarket Whale Rider just before Passion of the Christ, or monster films that seem to have a different audience than the mainstream, particularly sometimes an older audience. I think people assume, the studios assume, that an older audience wouldn't, they don't go to movies. Well, on Greek Wedding and to some extent Passion, and a film coming up called Thing About My Folks that I'm trying to get that audience in, they go like teenagers if the product is right. So I think it's really the product, and it also, it can be in any genre. I hear a lot of people say, well, wait a minute, the movies are, there's too many R-rated movies, and it's too, you know, the audience doesn't like that. Well, then Wedding Crashers come along, you know, and it's the big film of the summer, and it's an R-rated comedy. So, and the audience is loving that. So I really do believe it's product, but the studios, I think, have to, in some way, follow the independent lead, have more diversity, find broader audiences, meaning more niches. And I think the sum of that, if you look at the sum of everything, it could bring the overall total back.
Well, do you think, then, that the strategy of appealing to teenagers almost exclusively by the big studios and the blockbuster pictures has run its course?
I don't know if it's run its course, but there certainly has to be a plan B and C. In other words, I think that, you know, based on the studio operations, their overhead, their economics, they have to reach the broadest audience. And I think I think people are discovering that sort of core teenage audience is not the only audience, and they have to diversify. And I think that they will catch up to the trends. I think that the independents, as Michael pointed out, some of those films tend to be the leaders, or like the farm teams, if you will, and those filmmakers can go in and make, more a different movie or more sophisticated or a different audience movie for the big studios too.
Well, do they, though, get the same kind of distribution, same kind of play that the blockbusters do? You mentioned that on the first weekend of a movie, there's this explosion of releases. Sometimes multiplexes will have two and three showings of the same film. Do the independents have a place, then, to be seen?
I really think they do. I think over the past 4 or 5 years, films like the breakout films, you know, it used to be, okay, well, Greek Wedding was one film, but I think there's been so many films break out that the theater owners really do look at this as a business, where they might have, you know, in years past sort of filled in with films. But I think now, if you look at the number of independent films, and independent can also be kind of a state of mind, not just actual, independently financed. I think it's a broad term. But out of the mainstream, both in subject or financing or distribution, I feel that the exhibitors support this. And I think when you look at The Passion of the Christ being one of the top movies of all time, it shows, and that was done, you know, we had, 25 people working on that film as opposed to hundreds. I think that it shows there is no ceiling. If you connect with the audience, and you can come from anywhere, and there's no ceiling on these films.
Again, we are talking with Bob Burney of Picture House Films, who released A Passion of the Christ last year. This is To the Point from PRI. Jason Squire is editor of the Movie Business book. He's assistant professor at USC's School of Cinema Television as well. Jason Squire, welcome to you.
Hello.
Bob Burney seems to be a lot more optimistic about the business at the moment than Michael Wilmington, thinks that in many ways it is responding to the kinds of concerns, or it can at least, that Michael Wilmington raised. What do you think about the movie business, the title of your book at this point?
Well, I tend to agree with Bob. Bob really encapsulated the state of the business today in a very articulate way. The box office numbers, especially attendance, certainly down this year, but box office attendance has been fluctuating plus or minus 15% for some 20 years. And if you take out of the dollars of 2004 last year, if you take out Passion and you take out Fahrenheit 9/11, these two extraordinary independent successes that went through the roof, Then you have figures that are a little closer to last year. So, yes, it's certainly a downturn trend, but not as alarming as some might have thought.
Jason Squire, the movie business book. Back to Michael Wilmington of the Chicago Tribune. What do you say to what we've just been hearing from our other guest?
Well, you know, as I said, there's two things we're talking about now, and that's the overall trend, which was what Edward J. Epstein was writing about, and the trend this year. And I can only say, as a guy who has to go to these actual movies, I usually see about 5 to 6 new movies a week, sometimes more than that. And I see a lot of independent films, and most of them are the better films, and all of the big films, of course. There has been a dip in quality this year, and it has been because of genre formula films that haven't been enlivened by new techniques and new spins new ways of looking at them. Wedding Crashers, which is a film I liked a lot, by the way, and I was surprised that I liked it because I didn't expect to like it going in, is an example of what you can do with a big popular formula genre. But I would say that it is necessary. I'd repeat that, and I guess we're all saying that to a certain degree. It is necessary to break out of the restrictive molds that the big studios have had for their tentpole pictures.
I'm going to interrupt you for a moment because we're going to lose Bob Burney halfway through our program. I want to ask him another question. You released Passion of the Christ, also My Big Fat Greek Wedding, and we're now talking about Wedding Crashers, all certainly very, very different kinds of movies. How do you know when a movie's going to be a success?
Well, I think my rule is you never know, and if you say you know, you're really in trouble. So I think that you, in the independent world, have a little more luxury of operating on gut instinct and rather than sort of going by research or trends, because I think we can be more flexible, and a lot of times, of course, we have the advantage of seeing films at film festivals than acquiring them rather than going in from a script stage. But that said, I think a lot of it is a combination of critical reaction, audience reaction, and festivals, and trying to avoid the trap of trying to follow a trend or follow research too carefully. It's, like I said, it's easier with the lower risk independent films. And I think one of the problems is with the studios, you're dealing with such huge numbers and driven up by everything, by cost of marketing, by cost of, the talent is more and more after a hit. So it's tougher to sort of in a studio turn the Titanic as it were. On an independent level, we can go against the trends, and that's our job. It's to sort of find niches that are not formula and move in and out of those very quickly and try and find a success. But I think you have to be open about it, and I think it's hard to do in a studio, but I think they'll have to learn. So I think in the 70s there was a trend like that too, where they started sort of hiring, Dennis Hopper and other directors to make the studios made essentially independent films. I don't think they knew what they were looking for, just nothing
okay.
was working.
Bob Burney, we're out of time for you. Thanks very much for being with us. Again, president of Picture House Films. We'll be right back with To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Norman Allen back with To the Point, talking today about the dismal record this year at the box office for Hollywood films. We just heard Bob Burney, the president of Picture House Films, say it's very difficult for the big studios to turn the Titanic around, as he put it, and find niches for films that perhaps aren't as formulaic as some of the big-budget films are. Back to Jason Squire, the editor of the movie business book, an assistant professor at USC. What about this idea of finding the niche? Do you think that's the future for better films in the future?
Well, it certainly is. And actually, I think the niche is going to be the key to movies over the web. So that's a whole other horizon that may be a topic for another time, but in the theatrical market, certainly finding the niche is going to be terribly difficult, challenging, but there is a hungry, movie-going audience out there, eager for different movies. Look at the success of March of the Penguins this summer. It comes from out of nowhere, and it's one of the sleeper hits. On the other hand, we should also give some credit to a studio movie over at Warner Brothers, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Village Roadshow and Warner Brothers, a very expensive movie that you certainly can't put in some kind of category. And I think it's the most just the most appealing movie of the summer. This is a very risky movie. This is a $150 million budget. So there is some hope, even though certainly what Michael says is true about disappointing the audience this summer. And the business, of course, is very concerned about reduced expectations in the theatrical marketplace.
Reduced expectations on the part of that audience that you say is hungry for good movies.
Exactly right.
Again, Jason Squires, editor of the Movie Business Book. James Sirwicki, staff writer for The New Yorker, where he writes the financial column, and recently turned his attention to DVDs and the impact that they are having on the movie business and what role they might be playing in the box office problems this summer. And James Sirwicki, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us about the DVDs, and to what extent do you think they're partly responsible for what we're hearing?
Well, I think they certainly are important in terms of the shift away to some extent from theater going. But, you know, I think the real importance of the DVD is that in a lot of ways it is more relevant to Hollywood's bottom line than the box office is now. You know, profit margins on DVDs are very, very high. And if you actually look at the numbers, you know, most on many, many movies, DVDs will actually account for a higher percentage of the profits than the box office will. So to some extent, the kind of resolute focus on the box office, which is really a legacy of obviously Hollywood history, doesn't really capture the entire picture. You really have to look at how films are doing on DVD to understand to understand what's really going on. One of the things I think, and one of the arguments I make in this piece that I wrote, is that I don't think Hollywood, although it certainly has, you know, gone full on into the DVD in terms of its releases, et cetera, I don't think it's fully adapted to the possibilities that the DVD opens up in terms of the kinds of movies you can make and still make quite a bit of money. So I think you keep all this niche market stuff that we've been talking about, it isn't just that you can make better movies by tapping into the niche markets. I think you can actually make better movies, cheaper movies, and end up making more money because of the possibilities that the DVD opens up.
Mark Cuban, one of the very wealthy movie distributors and theater owners, has said recently that they could eliminate the window referred to by Bob Burney earlier, which is the time between the release in theaters and then the release to DVD and then the release to cable and so on. I'm not sure I have those in the right order, but
right.
In any case, there's a series of things that happen. And the president of Warner Brothers recently said that we may see premieres occurring at Walmart, kind of a funny way to refer to this question. But do you think that's going to happen? The windows are going to be cut back? You're going to be able to get the movie on DVD as soon as you can in the theater?
Well, I think it definitely is going to depend on the kind of film. I mean, I think we do need to be careful. I don't think the studios can afford to sort of give up the, say, $450 million that Finding Nemo made at the box office. And it's going to be hard to recapture that, I think, automatically on DVD. And even Cuban, I think, has something in mind where, you know, if you buy the DVD in the first couple weeks or maybe the first couple months, you'll be paying a real premium price to be able to see it at home. But I do think, you know, somewhere down the road, you're going to end up with a much narrower window. And, you know, theater going, I think, is probably going to change in really important ways. You know, last night, I went to see The Island which I'd written about as sort of a bomb with my girlfriend. And, you know, it was the classic thing. It cost us probably $32, including ticket prices and popcorn and soda. And, you know, I mean, if I watch that on DVD in a couple months, I'd be able to see it for, even if I bought the DVD, for $14. So, you know, that's a pretty big gap, and I think it's going to be harder for theaters to fill it.
They have a lot of advertising before the movie came on?
Yeah, there was, you know, the 20 minutes of advertising, the 20, whatever that thing is, plus also, you know, the trailers, although I enjoy watching the trailers, but, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of trailers.
James Sawicki with the New York Times, excuse me, the New Yorker magazine. John Fithian is president of the National Association of Theater Owners. John Fithian, the appropriate time for you to come into this conversation. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
What about the kind of criticism that we're hearing about theaters, that it costs too much, that you have to watch the ads, that the audience is unruly, that you got to park and so on, whereas if you wait for the DVD, you can do it all at home? Do you think that, first of all, before you answer all those questions, is the DVD becoming more relevant to the bottom line than box office?
Well, certainly the DVD is a complementary source of income for the studios that make our movies, and we're glad they have that source of income. When they have ancillary markets from which they can derive greater profits, it allows them to pump even more money back into movie making in the future. So we don't see the DVD sales in and of their own right as a big challenge to theater going. There are.
What if they close the windows?
The window closing is a much different issue. We believe that the theatrical release is the prime way that movies are talked about, written about. The magic of going out to the movies where you can have a shared experience with your fellow human beings is something that just can't be replicated at home. And most of the studios understand that and therefore use the theatrical release to make some money, but also to create the buzz and excitement about their pictures.
Well, we do have all these other issues we were just talking about with James Sawicki, and there's an AP poll out now that says 73% of the people they talked to would rather watch the movie at home than at the theater. How are theater owners, of which you represent as president of the National Association, going to react to facts like that?
Well, interesting is that survey was conducted with people who were at home and not out at movies at the same time that they were conducting the survey. But I think we have to look at some long-term trends on theater going, because this year has been a slump, no doubt. I agree with all of your previous participants who have ascribed that slump to the nature of the movies this year. We just have not had very popular movies that have stuck, and that's part of the mystery of this business. You don't know what's going to work until you actually start trying to sell tickets to the movie. But the history of movie going is strong. Yes, television hit movie going hard in the 50s and the 60s. And then an interesting thing happened beginning in 1970 and stretching over the subsequent 35 years. Americans started going back to the movies in very strong numbers. Between 1970 and 2004, 67% increase in the number of people going to the movies, while the population only increased 43%. In other words, despite this slump of this year, Americans are going to the movies more often now than they did a generation ago. So we don't view any big structural problem with the industry. We think that movie going still provides the excitement of the social experience, a way to get out of the house, a way to see the picture on the big screen with the right sound systems and the right quality. And we know that when the movies return and when they get better again, our patrons will come back.
Let me go back to James Sawicki with the New Yorker magazine. Sound systems with the right quality, they're getting pretty good in home entertainment settings, aren't they?
Well, I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, I have a 60-inch television and a pretty good sound system. And so, I think there is real competition from home theaters, and I anticipate that getting better in the future. You know, but the truth is, I think that there's much to what's just been said. I mean, we went to the movies last night, and, I go to the movies pretty regularly. But I do think that, for me, the real issue is more on the studio side. That is to say, does it really make economic sense for the studios to continue to put $120, $150 million into these movies, and that they are often just barely breaking even on or not, not earning any kind of profit on actually taking a huge bath? I mean, something like The Island or Stealth, these movies that they invested literally $120, $160 million if you count marketing costs. And I also think one of the things the studios need to think about, and this is the real challenge for theaters, is that it's not clear to me that opening movies in 3,000 theaters or 3,500 theaters, that is to say paying for prints for each one of those theaters, paying for these massive marketing campaigns, really makes sense from an economic point of view, given the economics of the DVD, where you don't really need to do all that to really, I think, reap tremendous economic benefits on the back end.
John Fithian, again, with the Theater Owners Association, what about those kinds of practices? Are those things that you and other theater owners would just as soon see change?
Well, it depends on the movie. Diversity of movies, which is something that Bob Burney and Jason Squire and others all talked about, is the key to success of our business. We love independent pictures like March of the Penguins and Big Fat Greek Wedding and Passion of the Christ and Fahrenheit 9/11 that complement the diversity of our movie fair to go along with the bigger pictures that open wide and have the big budgets. And so the key to success for the exhibition business is to have a diversity of product where everybody can have something that they would like to see. Earlier in the conversation today, we heard the reference to there being too many R-rated movies, and I personally agree with that. There are many more R-rated pictures made than there are family pictures. Family pictures tend to gross more. They tend to do better. They bring in, you know, more elements of the family into the audience. And so diversity is the real key. On the specific question you asked, not all pictures need to open wide on 3 or 4,000 prints, and indeed there are probably too many pictures that do open wide. There's a great history of success of surprise movies that start off small with 50 or 100 playdates around the country, get some audience attraction, get some buzz on the internet, get some people talking around the water cooler at work, and turn out to be huge successes. That's how A Greek Wedding grew. That's how a lot of pictures have grown, and we're seeing it again this year.
Isn't that difficult, though, when there's so much emphasis on the first weekend, and if a movie doesn't do extremely well on the first weekend, it often gets pulled before much of a buzz gets going about it?
Way too much emphasis on the first weekend. I am continually amused at the buzz on Sunday night and Monday morning about, well, this picture did so much in the first 3 days, and it's either a hit or it's dead upon arrival. That's just not the way movie patrons think. Movie patrons talk about movies. They discuss it with their friends and their colleagues at work, and they want to hear what other people have to say, and then maybe they'll go see the movie, and maybe they won't. So the longer-term trajectory of movies building over a course of a few weeks is healthier, I think, for our industry and, frankly, for the diversity of movies we can give to our patrons than all this big hype and focus on the first weekend.
John Fithian, president of the National Association of Theater Owners. Back to our first guest, Michael Wilmington, film critic for the Chicago Tribune. You said you go to 5, 6, sometimes more movies than that in a week. It may have been a painful duty this year, but what about the prices of movies? And do you think there's anything that has anything to do with the decline in audience?
Well, all these polls that they take talk about the fact that people would rather see DVDs because of the price. But I've got to say, as someone who's seen movies all my life, I would rather see them in the theater. I would rather see them with an audience. I would rather see them on a huge screen. That's the best optimum way to see a movie. The reason the audience has kind of shifted is because it's so much easier and less pain and less risk in seeing them on DVD. And I've wondered at times, and it may be crazy because it's kind of a revolutionary thing to suggest, since the audiences and the audience patterns have shifted so much, year after year after year, the ticket prices go up, the concession prices go up, the price of going out for a movie has just kind of risen out of control. Maybe it's time to start bringing them down. Maybe it's time to start bringing some of the rentals down, some of the risk factor for theaters, especially since so much of a movie's revenue is coming from DVD. They don't have to realize it in the theaters, and maybe they should give the theater owners a break, and maybe the theater owners in turn should give the customers a break, and maybe if those costs were somehow brought down, and I'm not naive, I know they probably won't be, then maybe that would help solve the problem, because I do think that since the experience of being in a movie theater is the optimum experience, that should be encouraged.
Let me go back to Jason Squire with the movie business book. What about that? Do you think that prices could be brought down, if there were less money spent up front on these enormously expensive blockbusters that seem, as we heard earlier, often just to break even or sometimes lose money?
Well, that's certainly a challenge and a really good question for John, because it's really an exhibition question since pricing is set by theater owners. Some experimenting could work. I remember there were a couple of experiments along the way to, depending on how you look at it, either raise prices for weekend nighttime shows compared to during the week, or lower show costs, ticket costs, for during the week. I'm not sure that experiment really proved much of anything.
Well, let's go back to John Fithian, the National Association of Theater Owners, and I certainly was looking forward to asking this question. Can you bring the prices down?
Well, it's interesting that there's so much attention given to the prices of movie tickets, and maybe that's because the movie-going experience is the all-American experience where everyone expects and frankly should deserve to be able to afford going to the movie. But the reality of ticket prices in movie theaters is that over the last 10 years, our ticket prices have only gone up on average 48% for the whole 10 years. If you compare that to any other form of entertainment outside the home, professional sports, live-action plays, music concerts, they've all gone up 2, 3, 4 times as fast as the ticket prices in movies have gone up. So the reality of movie ticket prices are is that they remain started and continue to be the most affordable form of entertainment outside the house. I mean, where else can
you get... Well, there's that question, though, outside the house. What about the competition from inside the house?
Well, those prices are going up as well. I mean, the average ticket price in this country for a movie theater ticket, if you take into consideration all the matinees, all the student discounts, all the things that that Jason is suggesting in terms of diversity of ticket prices, is slightly under $6.50. DVD prices have risen, are higher than that, and you don't get the shared experience and the magic of going out to the movies. So we think we've got a pricing structure that's obviously, you know, established individually by each of our companies, but a pricing structure that keeps the movie theater going experience open to the entire population.
What I'm hearing from you then is that even if the fall is as bad as the summer, it's not likely that prices are going to go down.
Well, I don't make that decision. The companies do individually, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for being with us. So John Fithian, again, president of the National Association of Theater Owners, Michael Wilmington, film critic for the Chicago Tribune, Jason Squire, editor of the Movie Business Book, assistant professor at USC, James Sirwicki, staff writer for The New Yorker, normally writes the financial column. I paid attention to DVDs and movies this week. And also our earlier guest, Bob Burney, again, president of Picture House Films, recently having released the new Gus Van Sant film, Last Days. Well, bluegrass music, developed after World War II, named for the Bluegrass Boys, a band led by Bill Monroe. When Del McCurry was growing up, everybody else was listening to Elvis, but out there in Pennsylvania, he was listening to bluegrass. Since the late 1960s, McCurry has had a band of his own, and he thinks the bluegrass tradition is going to survive for generations to come, as we'll hear in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point.
I've been around the block a time or two. There's good times and there's hard times I've been through.
After growing up listening to Earl Scruggs, Del McCurry learned to sing bluegrass and play the guitar and the banjo. In 1963, he got a full-time job of his own with Bill Monroe. After a year, he went out to California, but soon after that, he was back home in Pennsylvania, where he worked in construction and logging. But he kept playing and putting out occasional records, and he is still at it.
I think I played the game right from the start. This toy heart was broken when parting words were spoken. Darling, you tore the toy heart.
Two of his sons play banjo and mandolin with the Del McCurry Band, and their latest album is called The Company We Keep. Del McCurry, welcome to our program.
Hey, how you doing, Warren?
Well, real good. How'd you get that job with Bill Monroe?
Good question. Well, I was playing a little bar there in Baltimore, Maryland, you know, and I was playing with a friend of mine. His name's Jack Cook. In other words, Jack Cook had a band.
Uh-huh.
And I took a job playing banjo with Jack Cook.
Mm-hmm.
And just so happened that Jack was an ex-bluegrass boy. He had played in Bill Monroe's band here in Nashville for about 3 years, you know. So I got a job with Jack. And Bill Monroe came to Baltimore on his way to New York City. And that's how I met Bill. And then he offered me a job playing banjo then. But by the time I accepted a job with him, he wanted me to play guitar and sing lead because he still didn't have a guitar player and lead singer. So I don't know how he thought I could do that job, but he did somehow. And that's what I did. I accepted it that way.
I ain't seen 18 in a long time. I ain't seen my baby for a while. But I'll be home by Monday morning after I drive 200 miles.
Well, growing up as you did, listening to Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs and the Bluegrass Boys, being the lead singer and guitar player for Bill Monroe must have been heaven for you.
Well, it was a challenge, to say the least. I mean, I didn't think I could cut that job, you know, but because I had never accepted that responsibility before, you know. I could play guitar, and I could sing any part. I knew I could do both of those, but now when it comes to singing lead for Bill Monroe and you know, learning the words to all the songs he's doing, because if I'm the lead singer, I'm going to have to sing just about everything, on everything, you know.
And now we have a duet number here that Dale McCurry and myself are going to do for you, an old-timer entitled The True Life Blues.
Hi, to see sing low, just for his call. You ought to know, for his true love, I can't forget all of my sorrow. You'll soon regret.
What's the difference between bluegrass and country and western?
Before Bill Monroe got Flat and Scruggs in his band, there wasn't a whole lot of difference between the two. You know, back in those days, I mean, like Roy Acuff and Bill Monroe, they were not that much different, I didn't think, you know, way back then, except that Bill Monroe was a great tenor singer, but when Bill Monroe hired Earl Scruggs and he played the three-finger role, and I don't know, the music just changed.
Let me so sad in the world it seems.
At about that same time, country music or hillbilly music was going electric, you know, all over. And the singers probably sang like more baritone singers, I would say. Like they had baritone voices, you know, the country singers. And Bill Monroe was a tenor singer. So they just started separating right then, the two, you know, like in the 40s.
Are the harmonies and the rhythms different?
Well, yes. I'll tell you, for the most part, bluegrass is played right smack on top of the beat. You know, no matter how fast or no matter how slow it's played, it's played on top of the beat. And a lot of times country, you know, is kind of in the middle of the beat. It's more relaxed, you know what I mean?
So there's more drive to bluegrass.
Yeah, it's played on top of the beat without speeding, you know what I mean?
They'll go away.
From Nashville, Tennessee, the country music capital of the world, here's the Grand Ole Opry.
In 2003, you were, as I understand it, inducted into the Grand Ole Opry, the oldest continuous radio program in the United States. When you're playing with Grand Ole Opry, which is still on the air, do you play bluegrass or do you play country and western?
I play the bluegrass just like we do on the road, you know, the very same thing.
So is it co-equal with country and western? Does it have the same degree of respect?
Yes, I think so. I think it does. There are several bluegrass bands on the Grand Ole Opry, you know, and a lot of times they have guests too come in. Guest bluegrass bands come and play the Grand Ole Opry, and guest country people too, you know, come in and play.
How important was it to you in terms of your career to get on the Grand Ole Opry?
Well, you know, we were doing great before I got on there, but it's something that I always wanted, you know, to be a member of the Grand Ole Opry. It's just an elite group, you know, and because I had listened to it since I was a little kid, it really meant a lot to me, you know, and I just think it's a great honor.
You've been doing this for a long time, and so have your sons. Do you have to rehearse all the time? Do you play at family events when you're sitting around at home at night? Do you guys play music, or did you only do it professionally?
Well, mostly professionally. I'll tell you when the main time that we rehearse is when we go to do a record. We rehearse the material, you know,
sure.
and find the key and the right tempo and all like that. But once we do that, then we may warm up before a show, you know, but as far as having rehearsals at home or anything, we just don't do that. We're playing so much on the road that we just warm up a little before we got on stage is about it, you know.
Well, tell us about the new album, The Company We Keep. Are there new songs on it?
Yeah, they're all new, I guess, to people. I mean, I don't think people would have ever heard them. There's some... they were pitched to me on CDs, you know, on the road. People give me CDs on the road, and they'll say, look, here's some new songs, you know, I'd appreciate you listening to them, and I always do, because you never know what you're going to find, you know, or what's going to strike you to record. And then I wrote some. There's so many great songwriters in this town. There must be a million. And so I wrote three songs, I think, on this record with some writers here in town, some of the prominent writers, you know, here. And that was a first for me because I'd never written with anybody. I always wrote by myself. I don't know why, but I just always did, you know, until this record. And I think I've got three songs on there that I wrote with other people, you know.
Well, Del McCoury, keep it up, will you?
I sure will, man. And thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Del McCoury, talking to us from Nashville, Tennessee. Producers of To The Point are Christian Bordahl, Francis Anderson, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sharon Rimbaum. Managing producer Karen Radziner. Special thanks to Eric Oifer. And, of course, thanks to the John Coltrane family. Technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.